House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is January 30th, 2009. We're going to go just a little bit out of order. I have a witness for 2315 who needs to be somewhere else in the very near future, so I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2315 and ask Senator Walker to please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. That phone behind me. Wow, this is my first time back in judiciary. It's been a withdrawal for me because I've been on judiciary for a decade, and now I'm doing all budget work, so it's nice to see some faces. Thank you for taking this out of order. I have an eye doctor appointment in Eugene in just a short while, and I'm not allowed to speed on the freeway, so I need to leave at the appropriate time. House Bill 2315, did you want counsel to describe it before I testify on it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2315 comes at the request of the House Interim Judiciary for the Judicial Department. No, actually, that's a wrong summary. It comes in from the DPSST, exempts the caption at the top of the bill is wrong as it relates to that. Exempts from disclosure unless the public interest requires otherwise the records of the Department of Public Safety standards and training relating to an ongoing investigation of the fitness of a public safety officer or private security officer to hold his or her position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, if I might. And I'm a little bit under the weather today, so I sound a little hoarse. But I am here because I was part of the Sheriff Bernie Giusto investigation in the sense that I was one of the witnesses that was interviewed in that matter. My testimony was to be kept confidential in the document because of concerns that I had, and my testimony was not kept confidential. It was released in a draft document that was submitted to the press. The draft document was promptly put up on everyone's website, every media outlet's website, and everyone was having a heyday reading all of the information that the DPSST had begun to compile in their case against the former sheriff. Of course, I was alarmed to see my own testimony out there. But mostly I was alarmed that an investigative document in an active investigation was placed in the hands of the media to essentially compromise what DPSST, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Trainings, was trying to do. I would dare say that any police officer investigation would not be subject to the public records law and released to the media to tell everyone what the cops are doing and how they're trying to build a case against someone. I believe that DPSST falls under the same standards. Now, I'm a strong, strong proponent of open public records, and Mr. Taylor can attest to that, having been counsel with me on the Judiciary Committee for all these years. But I am sorely opposed to allowing the press to try a case in public. This case was essentially then tried on television. It was tried in the newspapers and the editorial boards. And the attorneys for Mr. Giusto were making statements and comments in advance of having the final documents. I think it also compromised other individuals who potentially were going to be witnesses in the case. If I had not yet been interviewed and I saw that this was a draft document and everything was released, I might have thought differently about testifying. Actually, I didn't testify. I was interviewed. But nonetheless, I just think it's an extreme compromise to an investigation. I understand there's a work group that's going to meet this afternoon that will discuss this matter further, but that is why I'm here, and that is my interest in this piece of legislation, which what I would have been willing to draft in the 08 session, but we felt it needed some time to sit and come back in this session.
Are there any questions for the Senator? Representative Krieger.
Tell us a little bit how you view what's now happening as far as its dampens people's ability or desire to come forward and participate in the process?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, I would say that would be true. Absolutely true. The question you will have to ask yourself, this committee is going to have to wrestle with, however, is once these investigative reports are complete and made final, are the is then all the material that has been collected, is that subject to the public records law, and is that then made available to the press and all of the media or anyone who asks? So that would be the question, and I suspect the little work group's going to be talking about how you would deal with that. But absolutely, if you knew it was going to be plastered over the TV news that night, you'd think twice about what you were going to say. And I know that one witness who was interviewed was pretty alarmed at the level of media attention that was given to some of the information that she had provided. I hope that answered your question.
Yes, thank you.
Any questions?
I would ask you, of course, that was kind of the high-profile case, but even in, I assume you would support the confidentiality, even in a routine case of an investigation, you want them closed until, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I'm hearing you saying is you believe that the investigation should remain confidential until it's completed so that the DPSSD can do their work.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would agree with you, and you can freely put words in my mouth because I will agree with you on that point. And let me point out something else. Now, I never expected retaliation, but imagine someone who testifies, the draft report goes out, the person who's under investigation reads it, and they decide they're pretty upset about what you say, and they might have you killed. I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities here that people could engage in, and I just think this is an investigative agency doing its job, and it just shouldn't be tried in the media.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a commentary. Are we going to have someone testify regarding personnel info, employment records that are confidential under federal and state labor laws?
There's other people going to testify. I don't know if they're going to address that.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator, for taking the time to come over today.
All right, thank you. I hope to come back next week and see better with new glasses.
I only need mine for seeing. Okay, call Marilyn Lawrence from DPSST, please.
For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Chair Barker and members of the committee, one of the responsibilities of the Department's Standards and Certification Program is that of professional standards enforcement. This includes conducting investigations and preparing material for cases that are related to the potential denial or revocation of a public safety officer's certification. The need to maintain the confidentiality of open investigations in both criminal and administrative cases is recognized in both Oregon public records law and in the enabling statutes of numerous agencies that have responsibilities for licensing or certification. Until late 2007, we were unaware that current public records exemptions do not protect from disclosure the content of our agency's open professional standards investigations. So when we would receive a public records request in those cases, our good faith practice was to tell the requester that the investigation was open and in progress and that the materials would not be disclosable until the staff had completed its work. In late 2007, an extensive analysis by the Department of Justice based upon a public records request and then a subsequent request to the Department of Justice to compel production, and long discussions with their legal counsel revealed that that was not the case. Our understanding had been in error. My written testimony summarizes some of the more substantive problems that would be created if the agency is required to release materials while an investigation is still in progress. but in short, our ability to ensure that all investigations comply with the fundamental principles of fairness and due process for all the involved parties would be significantly hampered. House Bill 2315 would add a conditional exemption to Oregon Public Records Law that would exempt from disclosure those materials related to an open investigation only until the investigation is complete and our staff has concluded its work. That is consistent with the practice that this agency has followed historically based on our belief that our materials were exempt only until an investigation was concluded. Representatives of our agency met this week with representatives of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, and that meeting was very helpful and constructive for all of us around the table. The discussions clarified our shared concerns, some technical concerns with the language, and our shared interests. As a result of the meeting, we are looking forward to working with interested parties to develop some consensus language that would clarify the shared interest in ensuring the integrity of open investigations while still ensuring the public's right to access materials that are related to the work that its government does. I'd be happy to provide more detailed information if you're interested or to answer any questions that you have.
Questions? No questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate that you're already getting together to work this out and come back with a product that'll
work
for us.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Tom Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. With me is Andrea Myers from the ACLU. Basically, I think we agree with the thrust of this bill. And I think there's only question for us is to work out exactly how the language would read. While an investigation is in process, for the protection of the person who's accused and the protection of the witnesses and to keep the investigation from being compromised, I think it's a good idea for these records to be kept confidential. As it's currently worded, this would become a temporary exemption. And when the report was written and handed over to the policy body, then the records would be made available. I think Senator Walker has raised another issue, which is what records are handed over. And I would generally say that all of the exemptions to the Public Records Act would still apply to all of these. Let me just use a simple example. The name, home address, social security number of a police officer are exempt from disclosure. All of those things would be redacted out of the reports. There was a question asked, I think, by Representative Krieger about personnel information or personal disciplinary actions, et cetera. Let me quote from the Attorney General's manual here and says, under personnel or personal disciplinary action, the policy underlying this narrowly construed exemption is to protect the public employees from ridicule for having been disciplined, but does not shield the government from the public efforts to obtain knowledge about its process. And I think that the Attorney General's office has already given us a great deal of advice and counsel that we can use in drafting this language. So I look forward not to changing the obvious intent of what you see on the language, but making sure that it reads the same for everybody who takes a look at it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Gallagher? Ms. Meyer.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. We agree with everything that's just been said. The ACLU is always watching public records laws and the public record because it's critically important that the government be both transparent and accountable. There's also, as we've talked about before, the needs to protect certain types of information and make sure there's due process protection. So I think we're going to easily be able to come to terms. But I just wanted to explain our role and our presence on this. In every session, there are many public records laws or tweaks, and we're always going to be kind of pushing back to ask, do we really need something? Because it can be a long list if you look at the law of exemptions and exceptions, and so we want to make sure that's done carefully. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Meyer? Thank you very much. I appreciate the fact that you'll be on the work group and get this thing back to us in a hopefully a workable solution. Seeing no one else. Brenda Lashman. Mr. Lashman, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. Brian DeLashmet. For those of you who have not seen me in front of this committee before in past years, I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, which is the state troopers, the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Very briefly, we obviously are supporting this bill. We had looked at the language. We are interested in participating in any work group that does evolve. And just one clarification of a statement that Senator Walker said. Obviously, the Bernie Giusto case was a high-profile case, but any other case under the existing statute and an investigation of any officer would be under the same guidelines as far as release of information right now. So it's just not that one case. It's all cases. And so we have an interest in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2315. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2353, possible work session. I have first up a panel, Chris Hall, Andy Morrow, and Jason Browser, please.
Yeah. May I be heard for one moment regarding conflict?
Although
I'm not convinced that there's an actual, either my colleague Chris Garrett or I, we both work for the law firm Perkins Coie, I'm not aware of an actual economic conflict, but in an abundance of caution, and also because one of our colleagues is appearing before us, I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Okay, thank you.
For the record, Mr. Chair, he's been conflicted since yesterday on the House floor.
Mr. Taylor, could you give us a brief
rundown? Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2353 comes to you at the request of the House and Judiciary Committee. States that a publicly traded corporation may hold a special meeting of shareholders only if the Articles of Incorporation and Bylaws authorize their shareholders to demand a special meeting, requires a special meeting called pursuant to the Articles of Incorporation and Bylaws to be conducted in a manner called for in the Articles of Bylaws. That's basically the short version of the bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You also have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you.
Okay. Please proceed on the panel, and you can choose whoever you want to go first or whatever order. Just identify yourself for the record. This is recorded for the record. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hall, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2353. I'm a partner with Perkins Coie. But I'm also a member of the Executive Committee of the Business Law Section of the Oregon State Bar and chair of its Legislative Committee. However, I'm not here representing the position of the bar, so I want to make that clear. House Bill 2353 is meant to provide Oregon public companies with the ability to rationally negotiate the terms of buyout offers and remove from management a potentially costly distraction firm running the business. It basically puts Oregon public companies in the same place that most investors and companies nationally expect, matching Delaware law as the standard that most go into. So backing up a minute, the bill, if you look at the whole bill, it's really the biggest substance is to say that it provides shareholders of an Oregon public company the right to call a special meeting only if authorized by the articles or bylaws. Currently, Oregon law requires a special meeting if called by 10% or sometimes up to 25% of shareholders. Practically, kind of looking at the reality out there, electing directors, corporate governance, shareholder activism, that's all done at an annual meeting. It is very rare to call a special meeting, which is very expensive. It's very high stakes to do for anything other than a hostile takeover. And in fact, I pulled our corporate partners in my firm last night, and no one recalls any special meeting like this called in Oregon, and people that precede my time here. So depending on a company's anti-takeover protections, at the more extreme, at a special meeting, an acquirer can take over an Oregon public company company's board within as little as 10 days' notice. They don't need to have hardly any discussion with the company or the board at all, can just do that in that short of notice. With downward swings in the financial markets like we're seeing now, Oregon public companies might be forced to sell, most likely to firms with headquarters that are outside the state. Oregon does have anti-takeover protections. They adopt statutes that just about every state, or I think every state has adopted, to manage change of control and to maximize sales prices by the board. But House Bill 2353 just eliminates this vulnerability created by shareholders being able to call a special meeting. And I do want to point out that shareholders will continue, even with this bill, shareholders will continue to have all rights to affect corporate governance at an annual meeting. If the shareholders want the right to be able to call special meetings, if they find that right important, they can do so at an annual meeting. They have the right to adopt a bylaw amendment at the annual meeting to give them the right at whatever level to call a special meeting. So I don't know if we want to go all three or open to questions now.
If anybody doesn't have any questions, we'll go ahead and let the panel go, and then we'll ask questions. So please, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jason Browser. I'm a corporate partner with the law firm of Stoll Reeves in Portland. I'm here to testify in favor of 2353. Under current law, shareholders owning 10% of a company's shares can require a company's management to call a special meeting of shareholders. This is a powerful takeover tool for corporate raiders, the vast majority of whom are located outside of the state of Oregon, and puts company managements in a position where they have to negotiate with those raiders with regard to selling a control interest in the company. In addition, the ability to call special meetings if they are called imposes high expenses on and is very time consuming on management of companies and diverts them from the main purpose that they're there for, which is to manage the business and increase shareholder value. The amendment that's before you would allow companies to, in their articles and bylaws, to specify who can call a special shareholders meeting. And that means that companies can continue to allow the shareholders to call it at 10%. They can vary the threshold to something different than 10%, or they can eliminate the requirement altogether and not allow shareholders to call a special meeting at all. The change is unlikely to have any unintended consequences. It's a provision that has been in place in Delaware and other states for many years and has not negatively impacted shareholders in any material way. The change is also unlikely to have any adverse consequences for Oregon residents who are shareholders. Current state law and exchange regulations require that public companies hold annual shareholders meetings. The SEC provides ample mechanisms for shareholders to get proposals in company proxy statements and otherwise make their wishes known with respect to nominating directors and otherwise making proposals. Finally, I would point out that the change is likely to be attractive to startups and other companies looking to go public, and will make it that much more likely that they would incorporate in Oregon. And I think incorporating in Oregon is important because it's a further strengthening of the link between these companies and Oregon. And also, many of these companies, as you know, are providers of good jobs for Oregon residents. And for all of these reasons, I would urge you to move this bill.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Andy Morrow. I'm an attorney in private practice with Foster Pepper in Portland. I have also appeared here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. I am not doing so today. I am here because of my interest in corporate law and my long experience in dealing with that. I don't want to add too much more because I think that most of the issue has been covered. The ability to call a special meeting or to threaten to call a special meeting is particularly disruptive to smaller public companies, and obviously there are more of those than the biggest ones because it diverts more and more management time and expense to dealing with the situation. The annual meeting provides a place to do that. This bill also applies only to public companies. In my experience, the special meetings that we do hold for our clients are generally in small corporations, and the issues are much different. There is not the same process of needing to go to the public and the expense that's involved in a public company's special meeting. So I would urge the committee to move Senate Bill 2353 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Thank you. This technical correct House bill.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah.
2353. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Smith.
I have a comment and a question. To the chair, I don't know if we're planning a work session today. There's at least one of us who has many questions about this bill and would love to dig deeper into it.
I'm planning on working it if we can. So
okay. So if you're counting noses, I'm a maybe, and would love work session another day to dig more deeply. But here are my thoughts. For me, the general question is: should Oregon have the best corporate code in the country or the most advantageous? And when are or when aren't those the same things? Should we have a corporate code that is a model for the nation, sort of Brandeisian laboratory for democracy, who has the best code? Or should we be the fastest in a race to the middle or a race to some other location, depending on one's view? Over time, I hope that the experts in the corporate code will engage with the public good in a conversation about how we can have a race to the top, a corporate code that has social benefits in Oregon but doesn't disadvantage and even has some advantages for Oregon-based corporations. So for me, I am concerned about merely matching Delaware law and having that be our standard, that if Delaware does it, we should do it, because I know that they have done it to attract lots of incorporating in their state, not necessarily to the benefit of shareholders, not necessarily to the benefit of the economy, but to the benefit of management, who therefore makes the decision in that respect. My last comment and then my question. In the current economic challenge, with as much crisis as is happening betwixt and among us, with global financial markets crumbling, I have less confidence in saying that however we have managed our corporate governance over the last blank years is how we should model future behavior, and that merely because it is the standard, it is the best standard and should be the standard. That is my comment. I am conflicted on the bill. My question, which is more narrow, do we have cases where, in fact, it has happened that management has been flummoxed by corporate raiders, etc., and if there's not a work session today, those in between, so I can read some examples, pro and con, would be helpful.
Jimmy, Chair Representative Smith, I know, first, just to, on the commentary about the, you know, matching Delaware, not matching Delaware, and just kind of a race to Delaware, I will have to say, you know, it's something that, you know, we think about as far as corporate lawyers and being a legislative committee, and there's a lot of feeling here that, you know, if we want a Delaware code, we should just adopt it, but we don't. And the idea, I think, is very similar to what you're thinking is, well, just because they do it doesn't mean we should do it. We think we can be better than that. We do, of course, look to Delaware almost always when we're trying to determine whether our code is the best code, whether it does make sense for Oregon companies, Oregon shareholders, or whomever, you know, in a large part because that is a standard that people are used to. And it's well thought out, usually there, and maybe it's better, maybe it's not. Ultimately, in particular, this is one of the situations where we think it is better for Oregon employers to have, and Oregon companies, to have this provision, and thinking about the downside of the shareholder, you know, Oregon, a place that we like to think of others and not just the, you know, big corporate giants succeeding, but whether you really are doing something harmful to the shareholders. Is this something really taking something away from them? And, you know, as my comment, we don't see in public company shareholders exercising any rights for special or shareholder meeting, and they certainly don't do that for corporate governance. That's all handled at a annual meeting, and so you're not really, we don't see a takeaway. for your specific question, which is, well, why are we even dealing with this at all, right? Because we're not seeing these meetings. We have seen the threats of these meetings, so kind of the gun to the management's head in dealing with these takeover situations. We have seen annual meetings called, or special meetings called, so hostile takeovers can, in fact, take over the board in Oregon. I don't think any has happened in Oregon. There's one in Washington happened 2 years ago, or at least that one was advisory. There's one in Connecticut. I mean, these things do happen. So we actually do see it to where these hostile takeover folks are calling the meetings. So we see the downside, but we don't see the, I mean, we see the one side, but not the other. So that's why we think this is somewhat.
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, I think, am I not correct that the Delaware law only applies to every corporation that's incorporated?
It applies to private companies as well, which is we chose not to.
That's part of the distinction we're making here in trying to make the Oregon law better fit Oregon and not simply adopt Delaware kinds of issues before. One of the reasons that this bill is here at this point is exactly the economic conditions, because one of the times that these things happen is when stock of Oregon companies are undervalued relative to the value of the enterprise. It becomes very easy then for someone with a relatively small investment to get a stake in a company and then start pushing to take it over. It doesn't require as much of an investment, and once they start that, it's a very expensive and time-consuming process for management to deal with it. And those kinds of investors are basically looking for a quick buck. They're not looking to do the best interests of anyone but themselves.
Mr. Chairman, if I could address Representative Smith's question.
Please re-identify yourself, too, so they can split that up on the tape when they...
Yeah, this is Jason Browser. I believe the General Counsel of Mentor Graphics is here and will be testifying in a moment, and I think he's going to address your question head-on.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the panel? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I believe you may know, I too have truly been wrestling with this question a fair amount, and it's a very close call for me. But I was recently doing some research in preparation for this hearing, and indeed I went to our law firm library, Perkins Coie. Now that you're a partner, you might not go down to the library anymore, but I still know it well. And So something I discovered, actually, in a treatise we have there, in Macy's on Corporations, that essentially Oregon law currently is directly out of the Model Business Corporation Act, and we're shifting it, which is essentially the majority rule. I believe it's directly applied to 22 jurisdictions, including Oregon. And we're basically, this bill shifts it largely to the Delaware law, except, granted, only applies to publicly traded corporations, which is actually somewhat to my surprise, I saw only followed by three jurisdictions. And I realize that functionalism is not necessarily the way to think this through, but I'm wondering, if the Delaware approach really is so much better, why is it that 22 jurisdictions still follow the model act?
Representative Barton, as the guy who's been working on this issue, as Council Taylor will tell you, for a long time, I can tell you that although the basic statute in the Oregon Business Corporation Act is based upon the Model Act, there are a number of variations. We've made, the legislature has made over the years various choices in various places to vary from the Model Act for reasons that were deemed appropriate to make the statute work for Oregon. Again, we're doing that here because we think there's an important issue that is important to protecting Oregon companies. And again, we're making the distinction between public and private companies that Delaware does not make.
Further question?
It's Chris Hall. And I think You know, as far as the other states, most states do adopt, they have the Model Act as the framework. That's absolutely correct. And most do not adopt Delaware as the basis for their code. And it's a little hard when you go out and say, well, how many states do this and that? You know, you look at North Dakota, South Dakota. I mean, there's just a lot of states that are not as active as Delaware, and that's why you see so much dynamic changes in their corporate code, is because they're a very active state for reasons that we all know. There's a lot of states that aren't active, and so, you know, they may have less public companies than we do even. So, you know, I wouldn't take that completely as a basis for making a determination about what we should do.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, panel. And next I call Dean Freed and Tom Gallagher, please. Please proceed in the order. Just identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dean Freed. I'm Vice President General Counsel at Metagraphics Corporation. I would like to make sure that the committee is aware that this bill is not just a theoretical issue. During last summer, starting in June, a large California software company made a hostile takeover attempt upon Metagraphics. Metagraphics is a global software company which was founded and incorporated in the state of Oregon in 1981. At the time of this hostile takeover, we were at a low point in a cyclical cycle. Our stock price was down, and the Cadence Design Systems, the California company, made a hostile takeover and approached our large shareholders and made it very clear to them that what they intended to do was call for a special shareholder meeting as quickly as they could, pack our board with new directors, remove our poison pill that would stop us from having the ability to take time to convince our shareholders and others that we have a longer, stronger interest in increasing our stock price and increasing the value to shareholders. We were quite concerned that within as little as 60 days we would be have a new board of directors. Fortunately for us, the corporation, Cadence Design Systems, was declared some very very negative earnings. Their senior management was removed from office, and their offer was withdrawn. So we remain an Oregon corporation, but we do feel that we were very lucky to have avoided this outcome of having a special shareholder meeting and becoming a subsidiary of a California company. We did a lot of analysis within Metagraphics during this period. We feel very comfortable that of the 1,000 employees that we have in Oregon, we would have lost 300 to 400 employees, certainly senior executives, HR, engineers, IT professionals, HR professionals, that would have been high-paying jobs. I think it would have been a bad thing for Oregon. So I'm also aware that Tektronix had a similar experience a number of years ago from discussions with their general counsel on this exact same point when George Soros was making a run at Tektronix. So thank you for the chance to add our description of Metagraphics here.
Are there any questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing Portland Business Alliance, Chamber of Commerce of the five county area in the Portland metropolitan area. This legislation was a topic of some kind of sensitive discussion in the legislative committee of the Portland Business Alliance, and it focused on a couple of issues. One, that there are fewer and fewer large corporations headquartered and organized here in Oregon, and over the past 20 years we've seen, you know, people like Georgia Pacific and others lead the state, large banks being bought up, incorporated in other places.
The second argument was that so many of the corporations that are here and still here were started locally. They were started by people in Oregon, and they've grown here in Oregon, and they've chosen to stay here in Oregon. And they decided to support this bill because any of these small pieces that help with the cost, the expense, the national and international economic politics and policies of other large corporations is beneficial to maintaining our job base and our corporate presence here in Oregon. That's all I have.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be a question that a future testifier wants to testify to. And I think there would be, you know, 9 out of 9 votes, or however many people we have here, that are sensitive, particularly at these economic times, to the challenges of our big employers in the state, without, I think, any debate or question. A question I have is about the confluence of state of incorporation with the state of headquarters. Recognize that we are fortunate that the sum of Tektronix is probably an example. I think Metrographic is obviously an example. One question I have would be, for instance, Nike. Companies that were born here, they knew a lawyer. They asked that lawyer, hey, would you incorporate me? They used the most nearby applicable law, and so used Oregon incorporations law. My question is then the confluence between where companies are located and where they're incorporated. My experience is that there is some, perhaps, overlap, but not necessarily very close, but you guys may know better than I.
Well, I can certainly speak to Metrographics.
Yeah, that case is clear.
And I also think, I think you're right, for a small company starting out, they will very often take the law of the lawyer that they're most familiar with. In the case of Metrographics, we have considered, do we want to be incorporated elsewhere? We like the idea of being an Oregon corporation. I can tell you this was a huge surprise to us, and it was a personal surprise and embarrassment to me. I wasn't aware at how much risk we were under when we had this hostile takeover attempt. And we are considering, again, is Delaware a better choice for us so that we can stay here? The other angle is that it's very important that we have every tie we can maintain to Oregon. When we started, we were a spinoff from Tektronix. All of our founders were from Tech and local. The current senior management, one's from Texas, one's from California, and there's nothing much keeping them here. And every time you move them a little bit further away with being a Delaware corporation, I am a little bit concerned that it gets easier to say, well, our headquarters is going to be in Dallas, or it's going to be in San Jose, just the way Boeing moved their headquarters to Chicago, so they wouldn't be so close to the employees up in Seattle.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we also have -1 amendments that should be before you. Mr. Taylor, could you explain briefly?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The best way was to go to the bill. You have the -1 amendments, and this is on page 1, the printed bill, line 22. After the period, which is after meeting, delete the rest of the line, delete line 23, and then insert the article. So it would be reading, you're taking that, it would say to demand a special meeting, and then go down to 24 and say...
But doesn't the first two words of that line say the articles?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Ziegler, that's just form and style of Legislative Council's office.
Thank you.
So I guess it was just easier to take the whole of line 23 out and say the articles of 24 of incorporation or bylaws may also specify what percentage of votes entitled to be cast on an issue proposed for consideration at special meeting, and then the line, it says under the amendment, line 25, delete not exceeding 25%. So it would be a period at the end of special meeting. That would be the sentence, the new sentence.
Are there any questions about that? We have a no revenue impact on that, so I do.
Chairman of the committee, we've got no revenue and no fiscal.
No fiscal, so I'm ready to open a work session. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2353 and open a work session on House Bill 2353. The first item would be I would accept a motion to accept the -1 amendments.
Chair, I move we accept the -1 amendments.
Representative Wisnant has moved we accept the -1 amendments. We need a roll call on that. Is there any discussion about that? Is there any objection to that? Hearing none, the amendment is accepted. I would now accept a motion to move House Bill 2353-1 to the floor with a due pass.
Mr. Chair. Make a motion to move 2353 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cannon has moved House Bill 2353-1 to the floor with a due pass. Take the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Nay.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnes?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. I'm just thinking I should ask Representative Cameron, would you carry this on the floor for us?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cameron will be the carrier.
Can I make a comment? I was, I didn't have a problem with this bill, but as somebody who grew up in St. Louis, the home of Anheuser-Busch, and as we just watched Anheuser-Busch get gobbled up by InBev, it just occurs to me that a lot of times we forget that the best way to make sure that companies are not taken over hostily is to have the founding owners hold on to their stock rather than cashing out.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, speaking to the record, I may well vote for this on the floor. I'm uncomfortable voting in favor of it here, sending a unanimous recommendation to the rest of the chamber when I have yet to hear a single argument, a single perspective that offers the perspective of the shareholders, et cetera.
Open a public hearing on the House Bill 2303. I'll call people up in a group if I could to this. Greg Warnock, Jesse Barton, and Paula Brown, please. And General Caldwell, if you want to pull a chair up, you can come up also. Or if you want to wait and do it. Getting set up, I'll have Mr. Taylor give the committee the background on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Chair, you may remember this issue from the House Veterans Affairs Committee. This bill comes to us from the Oregon State Bar. It allows a soldier, sailor, marine, or member of the Air Force, or a member of the National Guard on active duty to notify a creditor or other person that he or she is on active duty and protected by the Service Members Civil Relief Act. This act has been around in one form or another, Mr. Chairman, as a committee we heard last summer, since the First World War. And basically what it means that when a service member is on active duty, there's limitations as what you can do to them as far as interest you can charge in that credit card debt or suing them when they're out of the country and other things like that. Okay, that's federal law.
Okay, thank you. Please, so anybody in the panel can go ahead as you order you pick. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jesse Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, and I'm here on behalf of the State Bar's Military Assistance Panel, which I've been a member of since its inception, and which was in 2003. The Military Assistance Panel, by the way, provides limited free legal assistance to service members who are facing or faced with violations of their Service Members Civil Relief Act rights. I'll start by saying just really quickly, a real quick summary of what I consider to be like the two or three key provisions of the SCRA. The first is that it allows for a service member to obtain stays of civil proceedings, not criminal proceedings, but civil proceedings while they're on active duty. Typically, those fall under the category of foreclosure or eviction actions. The other is it allows for reduction of consumer credit interest rates from whatever the rate is down to a maximum of 6% while the service member is on active duty. And I want to make clear one thing. The service member, the SCRA, is not something like a veteran's benefit. Congress did not intend for it to be something like a veteran's benefit. The Act itself says that the primary purpose of the SCRA is providing for strengthening and expediting the national defense by enabling service members to devote their entire energy to the defense needs of the nation. The problem that we've seen since the inception of the military assistance panel, we've seen repeatedly, is that although the SERA provides significant protections to active duty service members, there's a problem with their enforcement. And very frequently, the value, you could place a value on the SERA rights that have been violated, the value of those rights is less than, often substantially less than, what it would cost for a service member to successfully litigate and vindicate his SERA rights in court. The best example of this, I think, is one that was brought to my attention a couple of years ago by another panel member named Mike Mendelson. He works in Portland. He represented, at the time, a service member named Jeffrey Linscott, who owns a aviation company called JL Aviation, which is headquartered in Boring, Oregon. Major Linscott, at the time, was a major in the Air Force Reserve. He was a helicopter pilot, and in 2002 was called onto active duty. That activated his SERA rights, as being called onto active duty. But while he was on active duty, a Canadian company with which he'd been doing business, having doing some repair work on a turbine engine for one of his helicopters, a company called Acro Helipro Global Services, brought a legal action against Major Linscott in a Canadian court. The company was made aware of Major Linscott's active duty service and of his SERA rights, but the Canadian company went ahead and proceeded on the action in the Canadian court and got a judgment against him for $100,000, which the company then tried to domesticate in an Oregon court, which is when Mike Mendelson jumped in with an injunctive relief action and stopped the whole thing from happening. By the way, the judgment out of the Canadian court called for an interest rate of 18%, which was triple what the SERA allows. The problem was it's extremely complicated litigation. There was $100,000 plus 18% interest at stake. With such complicated litigation that Mr. Mendelson couldn't possibly have represented Major Linscott free of charge. He had to charge him fees. And later, Major Linscott testified to the Commission on National Guard and Reserves and reported that he estimates his legal bills from that litigation at $135,000. And that gets me to the first and maybe like the key provision of House Bill 2303. If a service member faced a situation like Major Linscott's today, but House Bill 2303 were in effect, a court could order the SERA violator to pay the service member's attorney fees. So in that case, it would be a $135,000 attorney fee bill that the SERA violator would have to pay, so long as the service member gave the rights violator 30 days notice of his intent to seek attorney fees, which gets me to one point I want to make. There are some proposed amendments to the bill. If you look at the bill now, it talks about a 10-day notice period. I'll talk about the proposed amendments in just a few minutes, but one of the proposed amendments is to extend that notice period from 10 days to 30 days to give creditors a little more time, actually three times as much time, to cure the SERA violations once they've been put on notice that as things presently exist, you're violating the SERA. So that's the attorney fee provision is in Section 3 of the bill. The bill's Section 2 allows a service member actually to get damages in certain situations, again, so long as the service member gives his 30 days notice. Our opinion on the panel is that with what 2303 would do is put teeth into Oregon service members' SERA rights. We're figuring with teeth like these, we're going to see a substantial drop-off in SERA violations. And in fact, we expect to see that once somebody receives a creditor or some SERA violator receives notice that they're in violation of a service member's Civil Relief Act rights, that they'll cure the violation. And so that, which is what we want to see happen in any event. I also wanted to briefly mention the bill Section 1. That bill allows a service member to avoid arbitration over his SERA rights if otherwise the case would wind up in arbitration, so that he could instead have the case removed to circuit court. The final thing I want to mention or wanted to discuss are the proposed amendments to House Bill 2303. These are the result of some meetings that the BARS representatives from the Military Assistance Panel had with representatives from the BARS debtor-creditor section. There were some members of that section that were concerned that wanted to discuss with us creditor concerns with certain provisions of House Bill 2303. We've tried to accommodate those concerns as best we could. In one way I've already mentioned, we agreed to extend the notice period from 10 days to 30. Another is that we've agreed to amendments to make explicitly clear that the party receiving notice would be able to avoid or reduce liability by curing the SERA violation. We feel that we probably accommodated 90% of the debtor-creditor folks' concerns with the House Bill 2303 as it's currently written. Apart from that, we've also identified some other problems some other areas of the bill that require amendment. One is to Section 5, because we need to clarify the retroactivity provision in the bill. The way the retroactivity bill's provision is intended to work is that if there's a lawsuit pending when the bill takes effect, and the bill has an emergency clause, it will take effect when the governor signs it. If there's a lawsuit pending where SCRA rights are being asserted in some manner or another, if the law takes effect while that lawsuit is pending, the service member could grab the benefit or could assert the benefit of the new rights he would have under House Bill 2303. But again, he will have to give the 30 days notice, just like he would if in any other case. The other clarification that we want to have by way of amendment is to make clear that if there's a final judgment that was achieved through violation of a service member's Civil Relief Act rights, and then there's a proceeding brought to, say, set aside the judgment, when the case goes back to circuit court or back to the arbitrator, the service member could assert his SCRA rights. I'll give a quick example of that. I had a panel client once who, while he was on active duty, faced a collection action brought by a local hospital. And because he was on active duty, he didn't defend himself. A default judgment was entered. But the default judgment was entered in violation of his SCRA rights because that action should have been enjoined while the man was on active duty. He would be able to, under this bill, in a situation like that, he would be able to go back in, have the default judgment vacated on the ground that it was entered illegally, and then the litigation would commence again. But now he could assert his rights under House Bill 2303. He could assert his rights to damages and attorney fees. I should mention, though, that the provision of the bill, Section 1, that allows a service member to take a case out of arbitration and put it into circuit court, that provision would not apply retroactively. Only the damages and attorney fee provisions would apply. And there's one other amendment that we need, and that is it needs to be made explicit in the bill that Oregon declares that a violation of SERA rights is a civil rights violation. The purpose for that is to ensure that if a service member is awarded attorney fees under the bill, that will not be a taxable event. This is what I'm told is how the tax law works. I'm not a tax attorney, but I'm told it works that way. If you got an attorney fee award, that could be a taxable event, have to pay income on that. We don't want that. And the way to avoid that is by declaring that the SCRA violation is a civil, SCRA rights are a civil right. As I understand it, if you obtain attorney fees through a civil rights type action, you don't pay taxes on that attorney fee award. And that is it in the way of the amendments. I'll be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have. Otherwise, on behalf of the panel, I want to thank the committee and Mr. Chairman and the rest of the committee for having this hearing at such an early stage in this legislative session, and would ask the committee to approve our proposed amendments and then to move the bill with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Barton, we had two sets of amendments before us, and I don't believe any of these amendments address the issue of the civil rights issue. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So we'd have to get another amendment.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. There would need to be one last amendment. I do have language, though, available. It's just one sentence is all that would be needed.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Brown.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2303. Thanks to Mr. Barton, I think I can make my testimony very, very short. In supporting the bill, the department believes it's reasonable to allow the award of attorney fees when veterans' rights under the Service Members Civil Relief Act have been willfully violated. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you in support of this bill, and I appreciate the committee's time and effort taken to hear and consider this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. General Caldwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. We also support 2303, and I would like to make a public statement of how pleased we are that the Military Assistance Panel of the Bar has stepped up over the last several years and done incredibly important work with young soldiers and families that have found themselves in a whole host of different predicaments based on deployments. For the committee's edification, we have about 300 National Guardsmen currently deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan. We have 3,000 that will deploy in May. And I would say that probably there's anywhere between 500 and 750 reservists that are somewhere in the deployment cycle as well out of the roughly 3,000 that belong here in Oregon. So it's a small population by the, if you look at the total population, but it's an important one. Of the group that we mobilized yesterday, 157 people, 60 of those people have deployed at least twice. 27 of that 60 have deployed three times, and 8 have deployed four times. So this is not something that's, as we kind of all expected, I think, back in 2001, 2003 sessions. You know, we thought this is kind of unique, probably won't happen. The Guard and the Reserve have turned from a deep reserve to an operational ready force. It's a new setup. It's the way the country was actually formed. If we look at how the Founding Fathers wanted their military to operate, that's exactly what they anticipated, was that citizens would come to the call of arms and be deployed whenever they needed to be for whatever case they may need to be deployed. We're back to that. It's not your father's National Guard, it's your grandfather's National Guard. And I think that this bill, I think, is catching up with what we believe is important issues for these families and the soldiers, and I think Jeff Linscott's case is a classic example. And I think all too often corporations or other big, impersonal person on the end of the phone, credit card collector, or whatever the case may be, that's too easy to sit in Delaware and call Oregon and raise hell about somebody's credit card when, in fact, they're protected. And they do that quite often. We see a lot of that. The last statement I'll make is that, as you know, this legislature has provided funds for our relief fund over the last two bienniums. That fund has been used, I think, wisely, but nevertheless, it's been used at a great pace because of some of these very issues that we're trying to protect with this law. It was $500,000 each session, and a good deal of those monies we end up with people that got themselves in a bind, could have used the SCRA, didn't use it for one reason or another, have a judgment, have some other problem, and we've tried to use those monies to help them get out of it. Now, granted, a lot of it's ignorance, and we can always say, well, you know, the soldier should have known, we brief them, we do all these things. We do it with the families as well, but the best example I can give you is that one young soldier here in Salem left, went through his pre-deployment before they actually deployed into Iraq. He came home for his 3 days of leave that he had, or 4 days that they provided. His family was not a family of means, and they put all their money together to get him home. His girlfriend had his child, and he married her. During that three-day break that he had, they got married here in Marion County. The Army, of course, now he goes back to Fort Hood, Texas, gets on a plane, goes to Iraq, and now his pay is completely messed up because they had him down as single, tried to get it changed. He's on his move from Fort Hood to Iraq, different people doing it. Took us several months to get this thing and get it fixed. One, we used a relief fund to help when we didn't even know about this young lady. We didn't even know she was in the system. And so, and she wasn't in the system. We didn't know he acquired a wife in this three-day leave. So by the time we got that fixed, because his mother finally talked to somebody who finally called me, and we were able to get it fixed. But we were several months, and they were behind, and they were being punished by the lenders that they had for different issues. And instead of going through the SCRA, which we could have, we did the easy, quick thing, and we paid it, you know, with just got her out of hock and got her on with her rent and everything else. So it's not something that happens every single day, but it does happen. And when it does happen, it's usually something like that case where it's 3 or 4 months old, it's a big crisis, things are happening quick, and these people don't deserve that. So we fully support it with the amendments, and we're very grateful for what this committee and other committees here in the legislature have done over the last few years as we find these problems and we keep reaching out to try to fix these little things. Frankly, they're small by comparison, I know, on what you do here, but they're important to that small handful of 10 or 12,000 people that are living these deployments every day. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Warnock.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Warnock, the Executive Director of Oregon War Veterans Association. I provided written testimony to you today, so I won't go long here. But I would like to say that this is one of OWVA's priority bills because it may seem very minor and very simple, but as we've been hearing more and more in the news about the rise in suicide rates for returning military, we recognize that one of the factors is financial distress and family distress that comes from financial distress. And these issues complicate exponentially the lives of our military personnel. And we want to make sure that this panel, that this committee is aware of the problems associated with the SCRA and think that it's important, we think it's important that we put teeth to this act. And there are no teeth at this point, nothing. And it's important that we provide some sort of incentive for creditors to do the right thing in a timely fashion. We think this is a good bill, it's a smart bill, it's a timely bill, and it has no fiscal impact. So it's something I think we can all support. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Next, Mr. Hassan and Mr. Marquis. Cosgrove instead. That'll work.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. I apologize, Jeff Hassan had to leave, but Paul Cosgrove was kind enough to fill in for him as well. The Oregon Collectors Association, as the bill was drafted, had some concerns with the legislation. We met with the proponents prior to the hearing and are hopeful that a majority of our concerns are addressed in the amendments that were outlined to you. Our biggest concern initially was for a creditor who is trying to abide by the current law and do everything in due diligence to make sure if somebody is on active duty that there was some sort of recognition to that prior to a $1,000 penalty and or attorney fees on top of that. And I'm hopeful that those amendments, which we obviously haven't seen, and I don't believe you have either, but when we do see them, address that concern. And with that, I'll turn it over to Paul.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, and our concerns were similar. Essentially, in this day and age, as the General and others have pointed out, people are being called to active duty very frequently, far more frequently than we've had in other times, and a creditor or an insurer, and there are lots of impacts on insurers under the Federal Act, might be aware of the status of the person they're dealing with at the time they're dealing with them, but 6 or 8 or 10 months later may have no idea that they've been called to active duty. So our basic concern is to make sure there's a methodology in place that we don't become liable for a violation that we don't know is a violation, that there's a notice provision so that we can understand and therefore take appropriate action and have some days to take appropriate action to unwind whatever needs to be unwound. So that's the major concern, and I think the amendments are intended to address that, and if they do so, devil's in the details, but if they do so, I think we're going to be fine. There's one other provision that I was noting with the bar's representative just before I came up that I think is also of concern and has not yet been fully discussed between the two parties, and I'll highlight it for you. In Section 1, Subsection 4, there's a provision that says that any contract provision that has a choice of forum, meaning a place to have litigation other than Oregon, is voidable. And I don't have a concern about that, having the service member be able to insist that the litigation or dispute be in Oregon. But the next clause is of great concern because it says that or application of any law other than Oregon law to the service member who resides in Oregon. Many insurance contracts that you buy, many loans or credit card accounts that you open, or any of us do, are subject to and very specifically made in compliance with the law of some other state. And I don't think it's certainly reasonable, and it could cause all sorts of unintended consequences to be able to rewrite the contract and apply Oregon law. The contract was never intended to apply to Oregon law. It doesn't comply with Oregon law. Oregon disclosures, it has Connecticut disclosures. As long as the service person has the ability to have the litigation organ, and we think that's reasonable, but not to rewrite that contract term about which law applies to the contract. Other than that, I think we can work with the bar. We certainly don't have any intent to provide a loophole where people can do things that are in violation of the Federal Act. We just want to make sure that unintentional violations, because we don't know that the person is covered by the Act, there's a methodology for us to correct that. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think what you're saying there is pretty reasonable. I mean, as the gentleman explained, they take these people, a lot of young people that are getting ready to go, and they give them a million things, which they immediately forget because they're thinking about the girlfriend or the wife or something, and they're not paying attention, and that gets by them. So, and I'm sure the bar doesn't want the unintended consequences. I look forward to seeing a workable amendment come back. Any further discussion? Representative Krieger.
Oh, I think everybody here, and I noticed over the last 5-6 years, a real willingness and awareness of taking care of our veterans. Absolutely. I don't care who you are. But I have a little concern that when someone did a contract with someone and they didn't know they were in the military, had they divulged that and they knew they might be subject to this law, would it be harder for those people to get contracts and credit? In other words, they're not being informed of the status of this person that would subject the seller or the contractee person of the consequences when he's then called up. Maybe they wouldn't have given money to loan for that car or whatever it might be.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, I'm not sure I know the answer to the question, but let me give you my thoughts. The most common situation is when the creditor or the insurer doesn't know the person is in the military, or at least doesn't know they're in active duty, so it just becomes a surprise later on when their circumstances change.
Mm-hmm.
We have banks and credit unions all over the country and insurance companies that make loans and write insurance policies for service members. I'm not aware that there's any problem of discrimination based on the fact that that contract might be suspended or the premiums under the policy might be deferred for a period of time or the interest rate might be reduced. I think it's just sort of assumed that with a certain number of people that might happen and that's just sort of brought into the cost of doing business. At least I'm not aware of it, Representative Krieger. I understand your point. It would be a problem.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think you're aware that we need some more amendments, and there's got to be some careful thought put into this. It's not as simple and clear-cut as it might appear on first glance.
And appreciate that you're willing to work with the bar on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Two more items of business. I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2353-1. Don't let you vote. So that Representative Garrett can vote. How do you vote?
Aye.
Recorded. Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 2353-1. Next item is we have a committee bill that we want to drop to introduce. Mr. Taylor, could you give us a quick rundown on that?
Chair, members of the committee, this is LC 2311. It expands robbery in the first degree to include use of lookalike firearm, expands disorderly conduct in the first degree to include delivery of unidentified substance with threatening message, expands felon in possession restricted weapon to include taser and pepper spray.
Once again, we ask for an introduction to this. It doesn't mean that you're in favor of it, we'll support it or not when it comes back, but just to get it in the pipeline, I would accept a motion to introduce LC 2311.
Mr. Chair, I so move that we submit this bill.
Representative Wisnant,
draft.
Ask that we move LC 2311, introduce LC 2311 as a committee bill. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Not aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Was introduced. Is there any further business? No further business. Meeting adjourned.
Whoa.
Have a good week.
You did that with
Bigger.
Yeah.